I have to admit, I'm overwhelmed today at the prospect of preaching a sermon on faith and politics, given all that's happened this week. Troops were sent to our southern border to protect us against people who want nothing more than a chance at a better life. And while it's true every stranger is a potential threat, what does it say about us that we are allowing our fear of a few to dictate our treatment towards the many? The many who journey through the wilderness for a chance at a better life. Then explosives arrived at the doorsteps of prominent figures in the Democratic Party, and after a brief call for unity, the leader of our democracy refused to accept any responsibility and instead chose to blame whomever he felt deserved it. And then, when the domestic terrorist was found to be a man who is a symptom and not a cause of our toxic culture, instead of bringing us together, conspiracy theories about his motives and his van and his stickers tore us further apart. And then a shooter rampaged a synagogue in Pittsburgh. Another week where fear and hatred of the other dominated the news, and then I sat down to read this story from the Gospel of Mark. From there, Jesus set out and went away to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. Yet he could not escape notice, but a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately heard about him, and she came and bowed down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then Jesus said to her, "For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So she went home, found the child lying on the bed, and the demon gone. When I first read this account, it only deepened my despair. If Jesus could be so cruel towards another person, a person from the other side of a border, a person of a different race, a person desperate for help, then what chance do we have as mere mortals? If Jesus called a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin a dog, then what's to stop us from name-calling others? Now, if a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin doesn't connect with you, replace her with some other. To put this remark into context, replace a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin with an immigrant from Mexico, a Muslim of Middle Eastern descent, a Republican from rural Ohio, a liberal from the left coast. Do you have her in mind now? Because with your own Gentile of Syrophoenician origin in mind, you will likely identify more with Jesus' response to this woman. When I mean, he was tired from feeding 5,000 people, it's why he went to Tyre, a place on the periphery. He went there for a little rest and relaxation, and just as he was beginning to unwind, to unplug from the craziness of this world, one more person, one more outsider, disregards social norms, crosses agreed-upon boundaries, and asks for his help. And in response to her request, Jesus calls her a dog. There's no way to spin this comment. This is just bad. This is a low point in the ministry of Jesus. But just when it seems even Jesus can't avoid being infected by a toxic culture, the greatest miracle of the gospel happens. The potter allows himself to become the clay. There is debate among scholars as to whether Jesus intentionally plays the fool here to draw out this woman's faith and to teach the disciples a lesson about inclusion. Some argue this whole scene is a setup, a pre-planned moment to educate the disciples on what God is doing through him. But I don't think that's what's going on here. Jesus is many things. Deceptive is not one of them. What is going on here with Jesus is what's going on with all of us, in all of us, who have found a community, a people we can call our own. We find our tribe. We want to keep the circle small and familiar and safe. Instead of letting people in, we instinctively want to keep them out. Instead of loving the other, our natural response is to fear them. To be human is to resist the outsider, to protect the boundaries, to name call the other. But of course, we are more than human. Like Jesus, we are a child of God. I have come to believe the very people we struggle to accept are the ones with the most to teach us. Our Gentiles of Syrophoenician origin are the keys to our transformation, which means if we are privileged, the poor are not only the ones we are called to serve, they are also teachers in whose classrooms we must sit and listen. And if we are men, the women in our lives deserve more than just our respect. They need our attention because their stories are stories we need to hear. And if you're a woman, seeking to understand the challenges men face is just as important as calling out a man's inappropriate behavior, because our perspective is one you just don't have. If we are cisgendered, living in a binary world, the transgendered community doesn't just need our protection. They need us to listen to them, because they hold the key to our understanding how a narrow view of gender and sexuality can harm us all. If we are white, the stories of people of color don't just make for good books and movies. They are stories we need to sit with and wrestle with so we can learn how our skin color privileges us over others. And if we are Christian, people of other religions deserve more than our tolerance. They need us to approach them with grace because they have something to teach us about God. And if we identify ourselves with one political party over and against another, our salvation, both as individuals and a nation, is wrapped up in understanding and respecting the other's point of view. If Jesus needed his bias and prejudice called out by an outsider, by a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin, who are we to think we are beyond such a lesson? In the early morning hours of January 10, 1966, Sam Bowers, who was then the Imperial Wizard of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, drove out of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, to the house of Vernon Dahmer. While Dahmer and his family slept, Klansmen doused their house with gasoline and set it on fire. Dahmer's 10-year-old daughter was injured in the fire, while Dahmer died a few hours later. The Klan burned Dahmer's house to the ground because they had the audacity of allowing black people to pay their poll taxes at his grocery store. In August of 1998, after four mistrials and 30 years of injustice, Sam Bowers was finally convicted of the murder of Vernon Dahmer. One of the people in the courthouse for the trial was the Reverend Will Campbell. When he was chaplain at the University of Mississippi, Reverend Campbell had known Vernon Dahmer and worked closely with him on voting rights issues. Campbell was assumed to be at the trial to grieve the long-ago death of his friend. Courtroom reporters were shocked, however, to see Campbell being embraced as an old friend, not only by Ellie Dahmer, Vernon's widow, but also by the defendant, Klansman Sam Bowers. When one of the reporters covering the trial asked Campbell how he could possibly be so friendly with both the victim and the vicious murderer who had killed his friend, the ever-salty-tongued Campbell replied, "Because, damn it, I'm a Christian." The point of all this, and by all this I mean seeking to live a life in response to God's life-changing love, the point of all this is to be transformed by the renewing of our minds so we can discern the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. And the only way to have our minds transformed is to have our biases and perspectives challenged by the very people we deem unworthy of a place at our table. One of the critiques I've received during this sermon series on faith and politics is that I'm taking that in taking no side, I'm condoning behavior that is clearly against God's will. And while I understand the critique, especially with all the injustice of our time, I do not believe prioritizing relationships with other people, with those with whom we disagree, is hedging my bets or playing the middle. Prioritizing relationships with those we hate or fear is not condoning bad behavior or ignoring the call to justice. It is to stand where Jesus stands, with them. In one of the last speeches he made before he was murdered, Martin Luther King Jr. noted that for peace and equity to be realized, individuals and nations needed to look beyond their own interests and work for what is best for all. He called for a revolution of values, for the formation of a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation. In reality, he said, this is a call for an all-embracing and unconditional love for all people, in contrast to the self-defeating path of hatred and retaliation. In his conclusion, King said, we are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. We cannot hope to change the world with the same mind that created it. And the only way to have our minds transformed, to have our biases transformed, to have our thoughts transformed, is to admit that sometimes we are wrong and limited in our understanding. Sometimes we need to learn something new from the very people we despise. After the last presidential election, two young women in New York City organized something called Make America Dinner Again. The idea was simple: invite 6 to 8 people from different political perspectives into your home to share a meal and a conversation, all with the goal of remembering we have more to learn from one another than we do to fear. As people of faith who care enough about our world to participate in the messy political realm, we must be willing, if not eager, to have our minds transformed by the very people we instinctively deem to be unworthy to sit at our table. For the God we worship and serve, when given the chance to condemn some, chose instead to die for all, so everyone could follow in Christ's footsteps and learn from one another the full extent of God's love. Now, this call to seek relationships with those we struggle to accept and understand does come with an important addendum. You can't have your mind transformed by somebody who wishes you harm. It takes two to have a relationship that leads to transformation. But when the space is safe and the moment is right, we must seek to learn from those we instinctively despise. Australian activist and academic Lila Watson once said, if you have come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. We are in this together because we need one another to better understand God's love for us. In response to all that God has done for us, it is my firm hope and prayer that in this time full of hate and anger and fear, we would have the courage to follow in Jesus' footsteps by allowing our minds to be transformed by the very ones we deem unworthy. So like Jesus, we can discover a great well of compassion that lies within each of us, a well of compassion that can tear down any wall, welcome any stranger, and build up a world where all know they are loved and claimed by God. May it be so. May it be so.